John Bachman, who pierces in people's face. The K is for the kill, L is for the lover, and the M is for the mutiny, and I wish it didn't happen.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my drop?
Now the N is for knots, oh no, my bones are sinking. The B is for the peg leg that keeps me standing up. A Q is for quantum leap, R is for the rum, and the S is for the scurvy, which I wish I didn't get.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg.
That's underneath my boat. And B is for Mukitas, who plays a sour note. W is Tiasis, X marks a spot. Why? Cause I'm a pirate.
Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, arg, arg, arg. Pirate radio, pirate radio, pirate radio, where's my grog?
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQTRadio@hushmail.com, WSQTRadio@hushmail.com.
Welcome to Palestine Today, a service of the International Middle East Media Center, www.imemc.org, for Thursday, September 16, 2010. Palestinians demonstrate in rejection to the direct talks with Israel, and the 5th Viva Palestina aid convoy prepares to leave to Gaza. These stories and more are coming up. Stay tuned. The Israeli High Court of Justice had decided that a petition demanding a full investigation into the fatal shooting of two Palestinians in Awarta village near the northern West Bank city of Nablus is unnecessary, as the Israeli army had already ordered an investigation. Representing the families of the victims, Israeli attorney Michael Sfarad of the Israeli human rights group Yesh Din filed a petition to the Israeli High Court of Justice in August and demanded the court to open a criminal investigation into the shooting. On Wednesday, the state told the High Court that Chief Military Prosecutor Avihai Mendelblit had already ordered a military investigation that would start by the beginning of October, and the court ruled that no more investigations are needed. The two farmers were identified as Muhammad Faisal Kawarik, 19, and Salah Muhammad Kawarik, 19. The deadly shooting of the two Palestinians took place last March after Israeli soldiers stopped the two farmers who were walking near Itamar settlement. The soldiers then claimed one of the farmers attempted to stab one of the soldiers. A few days ago, a probe into the death of three Palestinians in the Gaza Strip indicated that all three were civilians and that they were killed because the Israeli soldiers thought they were planning to fire homemade shells at Israeli targets. In other news, a huge land convoy filled with humanitarian aid will be leaving London on Saturday, September 18th, in conjunction with other convoys from Doha, Qatar, and Casablanca in Morocco, and will be timed to coordinate with more international flotilla aiming to sail to the Gaza Strip at the same time as land convoys attempt to enter Gaza by land. The Viva Palestina 5, a global lifeline to Gaza, is planning to start its trip on Saturday, September 18th. The effort is being conducted in cooperation with the International Committee to Break the Siege on Gaza and several organizations from Europe, Middle East, India, Turkey, South Africa, and several other countries. The convoy will be headed by former UK legislator George Galloway and will start its trip in front of the British Parliament. Convoy spokesperson Zahir Bitawi said that six persons representing a number of solidarity organizations in New Zealand has arrived in London to prepare the three aid trucks filled with medical and humanitarian supplies. As the Palestinian President Mahmoud Abbas met with the Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu in the latter's residence in Jerusalem, hundreds of Palestinians demonstrated in Nablus and called for halt of the direct talks with Israel. The demonstrators marched in front of the Chamber of Commerce in the northern West Bank city of Nablus. They waved Palestinian flags and carried banners calling for an immediate withdrawal of Palestinian negotiators from talks with Israel. The march was jointly organized by the Popular Front for the Liberation of Palestine, the Palestinian People's Party, and the Democratic Front for the Liberation of Palestine. This concludes our news for today. Thank you for joining us from Occupied Bethlehem. You have been listening to Palestine Today from the International Middle East Media Center. For more updates, please visit our website at www.imenc.org. This report has been brought to you by Hassan Kassis and George Rishmawi.
Don't believe all that bullshit about U.S. combat operations in Iraq being over. Dubai, just outside Fallujah, Iraq, yesterday morning. An Iraqi military force backed by U.S. soldiers shot it out with resistance fighters early during a raid on a village in western Iraq that left 8 people dead, 4 of them civilians. No Americans were among the casualties. The raid began with an elite Iraqi military unit surrounding a street in Dubai, just outside Fallujah. Iraqi police and the U.S. military reported. According to the Americans, the so-called counterterrorism unit, backed by U.S. soldiers, was looking to arrest a resistance leader when gunfire erupted from several directions as the occupants of the home attempted to defend themselves. Balad Air Base, Iraq, yesterday. A U.S. airman was killed in a reported ordnance accident. Karbala, Iraq, yesterday. One U.S. vehicle was completely destroyed on Wednesday when a roadside bomb went off targeting a convoy of the Provincial Reconstruction Team north of Karbala City. Quote, the blast took place at the Al Husaynia area, 20 kilometers north of Karbala, a local media source told the Aswan al-Iraq news agency. Mosul, Iraq, yesterday, 9 Iraqi soldiers were killed when their bus hit a roadside bomb. This war is not over yet. And Afghanistan's just getting worse. Afghanistan, yesterday, 37 police officers and 8 other people were injured in another protest of last weekend's Quran-burning madness. Authorities claim Taliban fighters opened fire on police from nearby houses, taking advantage of what that crazy preacher from Florida served them on a silver platter, even after canceling his own Quran burning. New York City this week. That nut job who burned a Quran at Ground Zero on September 11th this year has been fired from his job with the New York Transit Authority. Perhaps this was for his reckless disregard of public safety? Afghanistan, yesterday, U.S. forces launched a major offensive in southern Afghanistan early Wednesday in the district that gave birth to the Taliban movement, and what they claim could be one of the most important offensives of the war. Thousands of U.S. and Afghan troops encircled and swooped into a belt of lush farmland in Zari district. Key insurgent held villages such as Mukan, Pajmul, and Singasar are the target areas, essentially untouched by occupation forces since they entered Afghanistan in 2001. The operation began at 4 a.m. local time Wednesday, approximately 7:30 Eastern Daylight Time Tuesday. Key offensive of the war, that's been said before, in places from Pakistan's Swat Valley to the failed summer offensive against Kandahar that turned into a Taliban counteroffensive. The year runs late for fighting in Afghanistan, and if this offensive bogs down even a little, the snows of winter will force an end to this operation. Even if U.S. forces manage to prevail, Taliban fighters, like all guerrilla armies, will bend like a reed in the wind, melting away into the population. They will soon reappear elsewhere, as again has been true in every guerrilla war since my Native American ancestors fought to defend this continent from invasion. Mr. Barack Obama, you should know better than to continue the foolish invasions of your predecessor, George W. Bush. Now's the time to really end combat operations in Iraq, throw in the towel and never conquered Afghanistan, and bring all the U.S. troops home today.
And no amount of money you could give me, honey, couldn't pay me, ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. I ain't going back again. You won't see me back there again. No, you won't see me back there again.
Amnesty International released a new report on September 12th titled, New Order, Same Abuses, Unlawful Detentions and Torture in Iraq, which highlights concerns about the treatment of Iraqi prisoners now under the control of Iraqi security forces after the U.S. transferred their authority to the Baghdad government. Through interviews gleaned from former prisoners and others, the report focuses on many kinds of abuse, including detainees being subjected to beatings, suspension by their limbs, electric shock, suffocation, threats of rape, arbitrary arrest, and being held without charge or trial. Amnesty estimates that 30,000 detainees are currently being held without trial in Iraq. More than 400 detainees were held in a secret prison at the old Mutana airport, whose existence was revealed publicly in April 2010. Between the lines, Melinda Tuhus spoke with Genève Montri, Amnesty International's Government Relations Director for Terrorism and Counterterrorism. He describes how the report was compiled and explains what Amnesty hopes will happen as a result to protect the rights of Iraqis regardless of their guilt or innocence for the crimes they are accused of committing.
Because of the nature of this subject and the security situation, a number of interviews were actually conducted in Iraq. Some were conducted over the phone and some were actually conducted by Iraqis that had been forced out, part of the refugee population or part of the larger population that is now in surrounding countries. Some of the core facts are frankly just not known. I mean, one of the facts is just how many people are being held. And we have an estimate that 30,000 people are being held without charge. So clearly, because we aren't going to be able to verify that from the Iraqis and the Iraqis aren't able to verify that, the real number remains unknown. Frankly, it's very difficult to get accurate information from the authorities. People will always say, look, these populations are shifting and changing, and it's a complex situation, those kinds of things. A subset of these people were frankly picked up by the Americans some time ago and held without charge, and some of them were actually recommended for release by the Americans, but under the status of forces agreement, both the prisons and the prison population had to be turned over to the Iraqi authorities. And so we're still dealing with the legacy of U.S. involvement in Iraq.
The U.S. behavior in Iraq regarding prisoners, it's a pretty low bar. Does the report then say that Iraqis who now have custody of their fellow Iraqi citizens are behaving even worse, and there's more torture and more deaths among this population?
Well, I think it's a complex picture. I think that by the time American forces were leaving in the last couple of years, you may have heard many stories about General Stone that went to Iraq And actually, by the time that he started his work and he was able to put in place a lot of very interesting reforms to actually get prisons in Iraq to a pretty good standard, where not only were they trying to separate the detainee population between those who were, say, hardcore extremists and those who were just randomly selected, but also running things like education programs, running things to allow people to develop vocational skills, so that you really didn't have a situation where people were being picked up and put into what he called extremist universities or jihadi universities, where they were going to be kicked out into the population in a much worse state than they were when they were picked up. Many were unable to read and write. And so they put in place programs to allow them to study, and so that they weren't going to be radicalized inside these facilities. Unfortunately, in the process of leaving Iraq, just because of the status of forces agreement and security situation, a lot of those programs are not going to be held in place for a long time. And you've got a situation where really you've got a continuing history really from a legacy of the Saddam era to kind of now. I mean, many people that are really many of the abuses that you hear about from Iraqi facilities, you wouldn't be surprised if you heard those stories many, many years ago. And unfortunately, although you know these facts are difficult to get, they're so consistent, they're from so many sources, and they're from so many different organizations, that it's hard to say anything other than there is substantial reason to be concerned about these things. Not only random arrests, arbitrary arrests, abuse of prisoners, extortion, corruption, a lack of access to lawyers, many people have been abducted, many people are being held without charge, and this has been, these are also people who have been held for some time, often years.
So is your goal to shed light on this and exert moral pressure on the Iraqis? There's hardly a functioning government there. So what do you think should or can happen?
You know, I think that there are a couple of things that really should happen. One is that the U.S., when it went into Iraq, or it goes into countries like this, basically turns their entire society upside down. And I think Colin Powell's rule applies, that if you break it, you own it. And we still, regardless of what the headlines may say, we still have an amazing authority on the ground. And we still have a considerable moral authority and responsibility for the things that are happening. The U.S. does have a very unique situation in Iraq in terms of its ability to influence the government. And it also has a responsibility for some of the abuses which remain. And I think the things that we're calling for really are that the Iraqi government, both because it inherited some obligations from the previous government, as well as the obligations it took on itself, has to comply with international law. And even the Iraqis' law that they recognize themselves, which is to say that they must release all detainees they are holding or charge them with recognizable offenses. That all aspects of torture or all use of torture and ill treatment have to be ended immediately and properly investigated. And anybody who's implicated has to be brought to justice. So they have to ensure that anybody that's picked up and is questioned has an access to a lawyer and is brought in front of a judge, which Iraqi law demands. And have to allow for a proper mechanism so that Iraqi detainees are able to challenge the legal basis of their detention. Unfortunately, another problem is that many people who are picked up are moved, and you can't tell where they're being held. Their families have no idea where they're being held. And they have to ensure that those who are being held are held in recognizable places of detention and are held within a regular authority. And unfortunately, many of the people conducting these abuses are part of the Interior Ministry or the Ministry of Defense, and it's being done for sectarian reasons or quote-unquote security reasons.
That was Genev Montri of Amnesty International. Contact their Washington, D.C. office at area code 202-675-8754 or visit their website at amnesty.org, where you can read a copy of the New Order Same Abuses report.
Suppose Army recruiting ads had to have side effect warnings like drug advertisements on TV do.
The United States Army may not be right for every patient. Side effects can include distress, disillusionment, bitter resentment, isolation, traumatic and post-traumatic stress, sociopathic behavior, uncontrollable sobbing, uncontrollable violence, prosecutions for war crimes, prosecutions for domestic crimes, loss of contact with loved ones, loss of ability to love, brain injuries, blindness, depleted uranium poisoning, flashbacks, horror of death, horror of being away from death, loss of the use of limbs, loss of limbs, death, suicide, excruciating pain, the desire to feel excruciating pain, overwhelming rage and misery, loss of hearing, punishment by the Army for failure to obey illegal orders, punishment by courts of law or by enemy forces for obeying illegal orders. Torture, humiliation, shame, dangerous habits of blind subservience, or the wasting of what could have been the best years of your life. If you experience any of these symptoms, deal with it, sucker. You already signed your name on the dotted line.
On the 10th of September, the anti-war vigil at Walter Reed Army Hospital received some low-grade harassment from what appeared to be MPs. The cars coming down George Avenue, some honking for the teabaggers, some honking for the anti-war protest. What went on with the cops that came by?
It's not that much. There's a Colonel McHugh, that's his name, Colonel McHugh, inside the garrison there, is offended when we have our signs up against that black iron fence.
Or if we put candles on top of the Walter Reed Army.
So therefore we've got this big yellow line.
So you gotta understand, you know, we can invade countries and occupy them. We can, you know, innocent victims are the consequences of the war. Our own soldiers are the consequences of the war. But we don't want to hurt the iron fences with our cardboard.
I was thinking it might get pretty nasty with all this garbage about burning the Koran.
Well, not here, of course.
These teabaggers are going ballistic everywhere.
Yeah. Well, as far as we can tell, so far, except for the screaming and hollering, the freepers up the street are otherwise behaving themselves.
That was quite a contrast from a year ago when a Friday Walter Reed vigil fell on September 11th. Hundreds of teabaggers showed up and some tried to invade the anti-war vigil. But this year they stayed in their own space, just made a lot of noise in a hospital area. Honking cars for the freepers on Georgia Avenue. Some honking for us too. Here they are, all those Free Republic people, teabaggers, that have been making so much noise in a hospital zone.
Over the last several months, America has seen an explosion of hate and fear targeting Muslims at home and abroad. Conservative politicians and right-wing talk show hosts have led an ugly campaign to oppose the proposed location of an Islamic community center two blocks from Ground Zero in New York City. More recently, a little-known pastor in Florida threatened to burn the Muslim holy book, the Quran, on the 9th anniversary of the September 11th terrorist attacks and received extensive coverage on cable TV news and talk radio, as well as international attention. Although the burning of the Quran was postponed, angry protests took place around the world, some of which turned violent, resulting in deaths and injuries in Afghanistan and Kashmir. Links between recent open displays of bigotry towards Muslims in the U.S. and this November's congressional midterm election can be seen in the comments of former GOP House Speaker Newt Gingrich, who has compared Muslims to Nazis and who said on September 11th that President Obama may follow a Kenyan anti-colonial worldview. An August poll by the Pew Research Center found nearly a third of conservative Republicans believe Obama is a Muslim. A CNN poll found that 41% of Republicans say Obama was definitely or probably not born in the U.S. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Sam Husseini, communications director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. He examines the connection between the emergence of blatant Islamophobia, Republican Party political strategy in advance of the upcoming midterm election, and the exclusion of Muslim voices in U.S. media.
I think there are lots of different layers to this, but I think that a substantial part of the right decides that, you know, that this is how they're going to try to, as they say, throw red meat to their base to try to get them all galvanized and make a lot of other people fearful and paranoid and so on shortly before an election. So I do think that that's part of it, but I think that there are, you know, deeper dynamics going on here. For one, there's this total long-term structural slant in terms of giving voice to the religious right and not the religious left, for, you know, to use a shorthand term of it. I mean, for example, right now you have 14 activists in the Nevada desert who are undergoing trial for having gone on to a U.S. military base to protest against bombings, drone bombings in Pakistan and Afghanistan. This Air Force base in Nevada is actually where some of the control of the drones takes place. That would seem to be, you know, a sensationalistic story, and a lot of these are religious activists and so on. You don't find stories like that, you know, getting attention, even if they're well-reasoned and, you know, have had some basis in them and so on and so forth. I also think that deep-seated structural things that leads to these periodic explosions is the lack of meaningful Muslim and other voices in the U.S. media.
Sam Husseini, what's the responsibility of news outlets when they cover something like this so-called pastor who's threatening to burn the Quran? He's got worldwide attention. People have died in demonstrations and riots in Afghanistan and other places. Similarly, you have former Speaker of the House, Republican Newt Gingrich, with presidential ambitions, going on the air comparing the entire Islamic religion to Nazis. At what point should the news outlets, make a determination, maybe this isn't news, maybe this is just somebody trying to get their 15 minutes of fame, or in the case of Newt Gingrich, sell more books?
It's not covered in the same way as a scandalous statement, the Gingrich thing, for example, likening Muslims to Nazis, basically. Contrast that with, what Helen Thomas said. She basically got driven out of journalism for making remarks that she immediately apologized for, that some deemed, were overly critical of Israel and so on. There's a way that type of thing is framed that demands an apology, and that's not what we see. It's like, some level of controversy around it, but it's, in a context of, publicizing Gingrich, either his possible run or, as you say, books, and not to say, this is unacceptable, and if you want to pretend to be a reasonable political figure, you better shape up here. I don't think that's what we see in the general media discourse. And in terms of this Pastor Jones character, it's like we all have to suddenly stop and, have a discussion with a member of the Flat Earth Society, to try to convince them that this position might not be a reasonable one.
Sam, what's the connection, if any, between the widespread belief among conservatives and Republicans here in this country that Barack Obama is a Muslim with this seemingly concerted campaign to attack the entire Islamic faith?
Yeah, it's sort of similar to the whole, he's a socialist thing. Never mind that, the policies are benefiting Goldman Sachs and other Wall Street firms. Never mind that he's, stepping up drone attacks in Pakistan and Afghanistan and, which are, killing Muslims. This right-wing paranoia streak in the U.S., culture, Richard Hofstadter called the paranoid style in American politics, it fundamentally knows no bounds. The centrist establishment, I think, tries to use it in some ways, and it also, on the other hand, tries to appease it, but there really is no appeasing it. Now we're, the Obama administration, it looks like, is going to try to sell, tens of billions of dollars worth of jet fighters to Saudi Arabia. And the way that this is all framed is either pro-Muslim or anti-Muslim. It's sort of besides the point. There's a tacit alliance between elites in the United States and the Saudi royal family and other elites that, the Mubarak dictatorship in Egypt, for example, and so on, that they basically oppress the, people in the region. I think more meaningful dynamics end up being obscured rather than being highlighted in how we look at this. The anti-Muslim bigotry, I think, in large part is used by the establishment, but the establishment goes after things for its own ends as it suits it.
That was Sam Husseini, Communications Director with the Institute for Public Accuracy. Visit the Institute's website at accuracy.org.
This is WSQT Direct Action Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington. We are news from the front line. We can be reached at WSQT Radio at hushmail.com. WSQT Radio at hushmail.com.
A federal appeals court ruled on September 8th that former prisoners held by the CIA could not proceed with a lawsuit over abuse and torture they claim they were subjected to in foreign prisons. The judges of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit, by a 6-5 vote, dismissed a lawsuit filed by the American Civil Liberties Union on behalf of five former prisoners. The judges based their decision on the government's assertion under former President George Bush and President Barack Obama that permitting such a lawsuit would expose government secrets and endanger national security. The ACLU says they will appeal the case up to the Supreme Court. The lawsuit was filed against a Boeing Aircraft Company subsidiary, Jepson Data Plan Incorporated, which is accused of coordinating flights to move CIA-held prisoners overseas, where they were detained for interrogation under the government's Extraordinary Rendition Program. As a candidate, President Obama campaigned against Bush administration violations of civil liberties, but since taking office, he has embraced many of these same policies. Between the Lines, Scott Harris spoke with Julia Harumi Moss, staff attorney with the ACLU of Northern California, who assesses the consequences of the judge's ruling that continues to prevent victims of CIA torture from seeking justice and accountability in U.S. courts.
The case was filed in 2007, in May of 2007, on behalf of five men who were, as I said, kidnapped by the CIA, forcibly disappeared into U.S.-run prisons overseas, and subjected to brutal torture. The reason we sued Jepson Data Plan, or the claims against this company, this Boeing subsidiary, are that the company knew or recklessly disregarded its role in facilitating torture. And we do have evidence that we allege in the complaint that Jepson knew about these CIA torture flights. They were actually referred to by company personnel as the torture flights. And the company made a handsome profit off of them. And so because of all of the roadblocks sort of that have continually been thrown up against getting accountability for the Bush administration's torture program, this was another attempt to try to bring justice for these men, for these victims of torture, and this time through holding another party responsible other than the U.S. government, namely this flight company that arranged the flights.
Julia, tell us a bit about one individual who is the lead plaintiff, Binyam Mohamed from Ethiopia. He was held something like 7 years and was, under his own testimony, subjected to extremely painful torture. I don't know how graphic we can get here, but maybe you can give our listeners a sense of what this man endured.
Yes. Binyam Mohamed is a 28-year-old Ethiopian citizen and resident of the United Kingdom. He was arrested in Pakistan on immigration charges and flown to Morocco, chained to the bottom of a plane and flown to Morocco, where then he was transferred to the custody of Moroccan security agents who subjected him to severe physical and psychological torture, including routine beatings, breaking his bones. They cut him with a scalpel all over his body, including on his genitals, and poured hot stinging liquid into the open wounds. He was blindfolded and handcuffed while being subjected to extremely loud music day and night. He was held this way for 18 months in Moroccan custody, and then he was transferred back to American custody and flown to Afghanistan. He was detained there in Afghanistan in a CIA-run prison where he was kept in nearly permanent darkness and subjected to loud noise like the recorded screams of women and children for 24 hours a day. He wasn't fed regularly and he lost 40 to 60 pounds in the 4 months that he was in Afghanistan, and ultimately he was transferred to Guantanamo Bay where he remained for nearly 5 years. Our courts so far have been closed to victims of torture and national security has been thrown up as an obstacle to due process, essentially.
Julia, with this court decision, the ACLU is planning to appeal to the Supreme Court. Do you expect the Supreme Court to come down on your side on this? Is there any kind of track record among a fairly conservative court these days that suggests that this will be decided in favor of people having a day in court if they've been subjected to government torture?
We definitely are going to seek review in the Supreme Court. It's always difficult to predict what the Supreme Court will do with the case. This is an extremely important case, and the justices on the Supreme Court do have an understanding of the world that we live in, and I think they also understand that the rest of the world wants to know if the United States can hold people accountable for torture. If this case is allowed to stand, the United States will be known in the world as having closed its courtroom doors to torture victims while providing complete immunity to their torturers. And so, you know, we have every hope that the United States Supreme Court will take this very seriously and will reverse the decision of the Ninth Circuit here.
Candidate Obama, when he was running for the White House, had protested against the Bush administration's misuse of the secrecy doctrine to block the public from discovering government abuses during this war on terrorism. And I wonder, do you think President Obama has adequately explained his reversal, his very dramatic reversal in embracing many of the same policies of the Bush administration in terms of secrecy and continuing programs like extraordinary rendition and even now the Obama administration's targeting of an American citizen for assassination in Yemen?
I don't think you can explain it adequately. I mean, you can't explain it adequately because it's the wrong position. It's the wrong position that victims of torture should not be able to seek redress in court, and that the torturers shouldn't be held accountable through a thorough investigation. You know, it's the wrong answer to say that we should be able to target a U.S. citizen for killing without a hearing, without an indictment, without a jury of their peers. I think it would be impossible for him to adequately explain that change in position because the change in position was the wrong one.
What message does the United States send with this decision to countries where torture victims are trying to get justice and confront their torturers, confront their abusers?
So there are courts throughout the world which will continue to work to allow people to seek redress for torture and for international human rights violations, and then there are countries that won't. The message this sends to the world, if this decision is allowed to stand, is that the United States is one of the countries that doesn't, which is not what most of us want to believe about our country. So we do hope that the Supreme Court will reverse this decision and uphold our reputation in the world.
That was Julia Harumi Mas, staff attorney with the ACLU of Northern California. To learn more about the group's lawsuit on behalf of torture victims, contact the ACLU at area code 212-549-2500 or visit their website at aclu.org.
For the past 64 years, the School of the Americas in Fort Benning, Georgia, has been graduating assassins, dictators, and death squad leaders to do the dirty work of the elite in Latin America. The taxpayer-funded SOA has left a trail of violence and suffering in every country where its graduates have returned. Hundreds of thousands of Latin Americans have been tortured, raped, assassinated, disappeared, displaced, and massacred by those trained at the SOA. Enough is enough. Every year, thousands gather in Georgia to protest U.S. military involvement in Latin America. Join us at the gates of the SOA this November to honor the victims, celebrate the resistance, and pressure our government to shut down the school once and for all. From November 18th to 21st, we will have live concerts, speakers from around the world, street theater, workshops, and more. For more information on how you can stand with us to end the injustice, visit SOAW.org or call 202-234-3440.
U.S. Secretary of State Hillary Clinton surprised many diplomats when she compared the bloody drug war in Mexico to the long-running leftist insurgency in Colombia. At its peak in the 1990s, leftist rebels in Colombia, funded through drug trafficking, controlled 40% of that South American country. The insurgency has weakened since former President Alberto Uribe launched a brutal crackdown against leftist rebel groups like the Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia, or FARC. Clinton is now urging Mexico, the United States, and Central American countries to launch a Plan Colombia-style program to fight drug traffickers in Mexico. Bloodshed in Mexico's drug war has killed over 28,000 people since 2006. Plan Colombia has been criticized for its heavy use of military force, spraying of toxic herbicides to flush out guerrillas, reliance on American military advisors, and resulting human rights abuses. In her speech before the Council on Foreign Relations, Clinton claimed the Mexican government faces a well-organized network of drug traffickers analogous to a political insurgency. Prior to Clinton's speech, the State Department avoided any talk of an insurgency in Mexico. The Calderon government rejected the comparison with Colombia, asserting that it is resisting penetration by the drug cartels and reforming the police.
Welcome to War of the Trees on WSQT Radio, broadcasting on 88.1 FM from the heart of occupied Washington.
There is unrest in the forest. There is trouble with the trees. For the maples want more sunlight and the oaks ignore their pleas.
In a world of corporate domination and utter ruin, whosoever shall have the courage to take direct action against those who are ruining our planet and our very lives. On the 12th of September, two members of Rising Tide DC showed up at Adams Organ Day dressed as Pep Coal smokestacks, protesting Pepco's continued burning of mountaintop removal coal and continued rate hikes to line the pockets of corporate executives who make their living off the backs of both the mountain communities in Appalachia and of people in D.C. paying sky-high rates and threatened with Pepco proposals for guaranteed profits. So what are our demands from Pepco today?
We want Pepco to give us renewable energy. We don't want them making billions of dollars off of our backs and off of the backs of the communities in Appalachia where they're blowing up the mountains in order to give us electricity from coal. We want renewable energy and no more rate hikes.
Speaking of rate hikes, a community activist pointed out that Pepco is asking for guaranteed profits in the face of possible future declines in demand due to greater energy efficiency.
Is that people need to be prepared to fight Pepco, because as we are becoming energy efficient, and I say we, I mean low income.
Which means demand goes down.
Which means demand goes down and their profit goes down. So what they are demanding of legislation is that they have a guaranteed profit. That's wrong. And D.C. landlords do it now, and we're fighting that. So we want to be careful to make sure that when Pepco is looking at the Office of the People Council or the other kind of commission, that they don't put their people on there so that they can get a guaranteed profit.
Yeah, they've already tried legislation once that did not pass.
That did not pass.
But lots of smoke in here from the barbecue. It goes well with the coal smokestack, coal burning smokestacks. Not exactly what you expect to see in a green pavilion now.
Exactly, but this is the reality. This is the reality of what Pepco is all about.
And don't
Pepco, they're Pepco.
Is your SUV running low on gas? Is your wallet been running on fumes lately? Well, this is Behind Pollution, offering blowout prices on regular, plus, and premium at every BP Behind Pollution gas station, where you can get a gusher of savings filling up that Ford Excursion or that Hummer. And never mind our blown out oil well at Macondo in the Gulf of Mexico. Never mind all those oiled pelicans. And never mind this burning hot summer of global warming. Never mind the voices that tell you to boycott BP for the horrific things Behind Pollution has done in the Gulf of Mexico. Just keep filling up that SUV. Just keep enjoying that gusher of savings the blowout prices at BP gas stations are bringing you. After all, you never liked seafood much anyway.
Well, DNA is natural, it's the building block of life. And when the good Lord put it together, you know, I think he did it upright. He made lots of different organisms, a complex web of life. each one depending on another, and so the circle had closed up tight. But then along came a man in a microscope, and he separated the genes. And when he put them all back together, he made lots of strange, unnatural things. And now food crops grow on the ocean floor, cows that grow on trees. Now the ranchers gaze while their oysters graze on grass that depends on a hormone spray in our genetically modified world.
On the 4th of September, protesters showed up here at 1630 B 19th Street, back in the alley where Michael Pace, head of government relations for Goldman Sachs, lives. Goldman Sachs, through its investments in Fortress, has been propping up Huntington Life Sciences, a contract animal tester.
Shareholder in Fortress, the life support system of Huntington Life Sciences. Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing facility that murders 500 animals each and every day of the week. They've been exposed in 7 separate undercover investigations for punching 4-month-old beagle puppies in the face, dissecting live primates, and mutilating rabbits to the highest bidder. And Michael Pace, you are directly responsible for this. Because, see, you know exactly what you need to do, Michael. You need to end your and sell all your shares with Fortress, the life support system of Huntington Life Sciences. We're not going away. The 500 animals died today!
Michael Pace is to blame!
500 animals suffered in pain!
Michael Pace is to blame!
Michael Pace for the cat and for the mouse!
We are here outside your house!
Michael Pace for the beagle, for the mouse!
We are here outside your house!
For the rabbit, for the mouse!
We are here outside your house!
For the your money!
Your fault!
Your greed!
Your fault!
Your job!
Your fault!
Your company!
Your fault!
Your 20 minutes!
No cops!
Been 20 minutes!
No cops!
Michael Pace, it's been 20 minutes!
No cops!
Oh, Lord, yes, it's been 20.
Finally, after about half an hour of protesters having a total free hand, two cops arrived, only to tell agitated neighbors that protesters had every legal right to be there.
Got some neighbors supporting us, another neighbor agitated, trying to get the cops to do something about the protest when the law and the First Amendment say that the police can only stand and watch.
He's actually in the corner there.
Polluting the land, polluting the water.
Dropping off the animals'
blood. Oh, Lord, yes.
Polluting the water.
Time of the protest. Word came out that Goldman Sachs had just dumped 2/3 of their shares in Fortress, 1/3 left to go. If other investors follow suit, Fortress will go bankrupt, and after them, Huntington Life Sciences as well.
That's right,
enough.
The shutdown of Huntington Life Sciences forever. Now Huntington Life Sciences is over $100 million in debt because of your ties with Fortress. And
that's where the money came from.
For the reason Huntington Life Sciences is still in existence today. So Michael Pace, you need to go in on Monday. Go tell Roy Blankfein they need to sell all their shares with Huntington Life Sciences. We're not going away. We're not backing down. This is our first time here, and it definitely will not be our last unless you sever all ties with Huntington Life Sciences and sell all your shares with Fortress. So Michael Pace, until next time, until all our free will be back.
Because in D.C. there's...
no sleep for the wicked.
The siege of Fortress continues. On September 14th, protesters showed up at the offices of Goldman Sachs, which has sold 2/3, not all, their shares of Fortress, which gave $100 million in loans to puppy-killing Huntington Life Sciences, where so-called researchers have been caught punching beagle puppies in the face. Next, protesters stormed into the lobby of Fortress stockholder Nomura. Don't think it'll be enough to sell only some of your stock in Fortress. It sure wasn't enough for Goldman Sachs, which also got protesters on the 14th of September.
Goldman Sachs, we're bad, because you still have not sold all of your shares in Fortress Investments, the lifeline of Huntington Life Sciences. We've been down here for weeks, and a few weeks ago, you sold two-thirds of your shares in Fortress. But if you thought that was going to make us go away, then you're very, very wrong, my friends. We see that you've brought out our velvet ropes again, too. We're glad that you're giving us a special treatment once again, but we prefer to end this relationship with you by having you end all of your ties with Fortress Investments and therefore ending the lifeline of Huntington Life Sciences. In case you forgot, Huntington Life Sciences is a contract animal testing facility who kills 500 animals each and every day of the week to give us products that we don't need, like Bleach, Splenda, and Viagra. They've been exposed in 7 separate undercover investigations, punching beagle puppies in the face, dissecting live primates, and mutilating rabbits to the highest bidder. And guess what, Goldman Sachs? 500 animals died today!
Goldman Sachs, Nomura, one of three things is going to happen. Either you're going to dump all of Fortress, Fortress is going to dump Huntington Life Sciences, or you're all going down with the ship. On the 15th of September, protesters showed up at the Liaison Capitol Hill Hotel, protesting 102 years of congressional bribery and corruption by the National Cattlemen's Beef Association, whose annual legislative conference was scheduled then and there. Several protesters entered the hotel. Got one person inside. Now two inside. Where are they? There we go. Whoa!
That's right! The National Cattlemen's Beef Association was just put by the USDA.
Don't touch my camera. That's fine, but no assaults.
From the hotel is claiming that the National Cattlemen's Beef Association has moved out of the liaison to another hotel somewhere on Independence Avenue, taking over 100 taxi cabs
at 11:30 last night.
We do not know if this report is true or not. It did claim that the National Cattlemen's Beef Association met in this hotel, the liaison at 415 New Jersey Avenue, yesterday.
Literally. Polluting the air, polluting the water! Polluting out the animal slaughter! Polluting them by mines, polluting the water!
After a while, the cops showed up. Beef Association really slink away in the middle of the night, loading up 100 taxi cabs at 11:30 p.m. Tuesday night, moving off to another hotel on Independence Avenue. Or were hotel staff lying to protesters, trying to keep these corporate corruption specialists from receiving a noisy bullhorn and air horn protest at 1 in the afternoon the following day?